Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Modern Retail Podcast. I'm your host, Cale Guthrie Weissman, the editor-in-chief here at Modern Retail. This week, we have Sean Frank. He's the CEO of Ridge, which makes a lot of accessories. It's most well-known for its wallets, but it also has a bunch of other really interesting things. I know a few years ago, it bought a well-known media property in the space of accessories that I want to talk about why it bought that. It also just got a really interesting investment from the YouTube celebrity Marcus Brownlee, who in my way, way, way back days, I interviewed him when I worked at Business Insider over a decade ago. But really, I want to talk just about the state of being a brand like Ridge today. Sean has gone on the record, I think maybe a year or two ago, saying that he wanted to do a $1 billion exit. So I'd love to check in on how that's going. And I just want to talk about how growth is going. It's an interesting time to be a brand. And so I want to get into all that. But Sean, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I've listened to several episodes of the podcast, so
oh, really?
Ready to make my mark on it.
All right. Well, thank you for listening. And I it's always nice when people say that they listen. So thanks for that. So let's start with Ridge. So it launched in 2013. Is that correct?
Yep. That was when our first Kickstarter went live.
So give the story of the Kickstarter. It was one of those, I bet you, 2013, there were a bunch of stories where they asked for some amount of money and they got a lot more. And I believe you're one of them.
Yeah. You know, and that can be a disaster. Like you saw a lot of companies raise way, way too much money and then they can't keep up with, orders or demand. And it was a really golden era of like launching a physical product company. That era is totally gone, that like you could have no idea what you were doing and just have an idea for a product. And I think we ended up raising like $200,000. So it was father, son, best friend. That was the original founders of the company. So Daniel and his dad and his best friend, Austin, made the product. They had some physical product experience. The dad was a special education teacher in Southern California for like 35 years. But Daniel got like his start in e-commerce, like modding Rock Band kits. Like, and this was before Shopify was a thing. Like he would just like have people PayPal him money and then he'd ship them like modded parts. So he had like a little bit of manufacturing experience, but he was an accounting student and he had an offer from PwC to go, you know, and do a soul crushing job. And he's mm-hmm. like, if I can make this wallet thing work, I don't have to go to that job. So he just went all in on it. You know, really interesting family, working class, Southern California roots. They did not want to manage anybody. So I joined the business in 2016. I had like an agency. So like we did paid media when it was really easy to do paid media, running Facebook ads. I had 10 clients. You haven't heard of 9 of them. Ridge was one of them. And the unique thing was that like absolutely no egos, like super outside of like the traditional system. Like we couldn't raise money even if we wanted to because nobody would have given us any money. Like we were scraggly little kids, but they had a great product that really worked on digital acquisition. I had an agency business that like, you know, was cash flowing and good, but Ridge ended up being 50% of our like take rate. And at a certain point, it just made sense to merge. We were doing website builds for him and customer service and ops. And Daniel and his dad and his best friend really just wanted to do product. And that's what they exceeded at. So in 2018, we merged. We spun off the agency business to some people who were, you know, actually operating it. And 90% of the staff came in-house at Ridge. And we've been growing the thing ever since. So I think that year we did like $20 million in top line revenue at Ridge, and we'll do over $200 million this year. So still privately held, never raised any money. I always say that there's 5 of us that own it. There's 6 now with Marquez. So there's the 6 of us who run this thing.
Wow. Yeah. I want to get into all of that. I guess my question for you is coming from the agency world. Did you expect to go into the brand world, or was this just a sort of fortuitous opportunity that came and you said, oh, I can grow this company?
It definitely wasn't planned. I don't think any of this was planned. I thought I was really good at the agency world. I was like, oh, like it's so easy right now. Yeah. We're running Facebook ads and there was a skill gap, right? I was 22 when I made my agency and Facebook ads were around for 3 years, I think, when I made my agency. So like there was this layer of like legacy media conglomerates in LA that like just didn't know how to run Facebook ads. And it was just really easy to like, you know, we worked with Butterfinger for like, you know, their before Gen Z was a thing, but like their millennial campaigns, like it was very easy to like get those type of deals. And I was like, oh, we're gonna do this forever. But really what changed my mind is that you can't exit agency businesses, or like agency businesses are only worth what the contracts are worth. And Ridge just had so much potential that, like, you know, in the boom of D2C, e-com, Warby Parkers of the world, it's like, oh yeah, this thing has legs, and it was growing really fast. So it just made sense to double down.
Got it. And talk about your transition, because you, was it COO you joined as in 2018? Is that the correct title?
Yeah, I was the COO in 2018.
And you became a couple of years later CEO. Sort of what was that evolution into being the top executive?
There wasn't much of an evolution. I mean, I was the CEO of the agency business, and yeah. the day before the merger, Ridge had 3 employees. The day after the merger, Ridge had 28 employees, and 25 of them came from the agency business. So, you know, it was really just when Daniel felt he was ready to take a step back from the business. He's still fully involved, but he had a kid, and we had to build the org out a little bit. We just didn't know what we were doing, right? Like, we had no outside executives. Most people who've been at Ridge, this is the first job they've had. So we just had to like kind of build up that layer of like, you know, now we have real executives from like a bunch of great different companies. And then Daniel's just transitioned to like a chief product role. So he spends all his time just thinking about new stuff to sell.
Got it. And you're at 75 employees now. Is that correct?
That's the last, we're probably at like 78, but okay. I don't want to leave anybody out. Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that around there. So like, can you talk about, and this is something I try to get from people like you, just if it happened, the professionalization of the org, because when you have a company that father, son, 3 people suddenly becomes 20 people, you said you hired a bunch of people, it was their first jobs, they were excited about it, but like hadn't worked in business. And now you have more or less experienced people. Was that intentional on your part? Where did that come into play? And how did you think about making this into a high growth, potentially exitable business?
We didn't really think about it until like 2020, right? You know, 2020, the world went really crazy, and people talk about like it being really good for e-com. It wasn't necessarily good for wallet sales. Like if you're stuck mm-hmm. in your house, like you don't really need a wallet. So it was a pretty average year for us, but you know, there was a 3-week period where sales went to zero, basically, right? Like basically 4 years ago, like around like, you know, early to like late March, sales just totally fell off because everyone thought the world was going to end. Once like normalcy started, like sales did start to pick back up. And then towards the end of 2021, we started like getting offers, right? There's this e-com boom. People were looking for fast growing e-com brands. And we had an offer from a public company for like $300 million. And they're like, hey, we want to acquire you. And then I started to just realize, oh, we are not in a position to sell, right? Like when you're a family-owned business without any sort of outside guidance, like no board of directors, no investors, you just do things the way you think they're supposed to get done, right? And they could just be a lot different than the way public companies probably expect things to be done. And, you know, that offer didn't end up going anywhere. The stock market crashed afterwards. Like it was the end of the e-com era, right? So we definitely missed that window. I don't even know if we would have taken it, but the reality is we weren't ready to take it. Like if the market continued for another 8 months or 12 months, even if we wanted to do the deal, it would have fell apart. Cause like the way we do accounting, it works for the IRS. It doesn't work for, you know, standard GAAP practices or whatever else. The way we do inventory buying, like it just didn't line up with the rest of the world. So since then we've been professionalizing the whole org. Have a CFO, have a very strong COO we hired from MeUndies. Andres is great. He's been helping like, you know, professionalize stuff. We've never did merchandising before, which sounds like really silly. So we had a chief merchandising officer who just like taught us what a line plan was, right? So like there's like these basic things in an organization we just didn't have. So we've been hyper focused on professionalization, and the goal is to get to like, you know, 100 employees, you know, have an HR department, have managers, like have a recruiting system, all that type of stuff. And we're still building it out. We're doing it on our own schedule, but probably by the end of this year, we'll have all that stuff figured out.
Got it. The merchandising part's interesting because you guys do have, I feel like people generally describe Ridge as a DTC company, but you guys very much are in stores. How did that come about? Was that part of this professionalization effort, or is that just something that as people liked the wallets, you got inbounds from wholesale clients and you decided to sell there?
Yeah. So we've never like touted a D2C flag. Like we were never like, we're not going to sell on Amazon. We're not going to sell on wholesale. We were just like, yeah, we should be where people are. Like we were very early to that. So we were on Amazon in 2018. We were in Nordstrom's in 2019. And the professionalization, like the merchandising came out because like we kept being frustrated with retail partners and they were frustrated with us. And I would be like, yeah, we have a new wallet coming out next month. They're like, well, we can't buy that. I'm like, why? They're like, well, we're supposed to buy stuff 7 months ago. I'm like, well, I didn't know I was going to make it 7 months ago. Like, why is it such a big deal? Like, and getting our business to operate at the speed that wholesale expects, like has strained out a lot of frustrations. And that's like what Brian, our chief merchandising officer, has done such a great job as is. Like, you know, we're in Best Buy. So we're in all the Best Buys and they want to buy things 8 months before, you know, they actually receive them, right? And just getting us to able to function on those type of timelines to have a wholesale like sales book, like we never did that before. We're like, yeah, just go on the website. That's the stuff we sell. They're like, no, they need like a printed thing and you have to like have a trade show booth. And there's just all that like inherited knowledge that like legacy retailers have that like I think the D2C generation didn't. And we for sure did it. So it's been like 24 months of us learning that stuff and like changing our organization to operate on those timelines.
And how much are you able to say, is wholesale like 50-50 with DTC? Or like, how does it work? Where do you get most of your sales from now?
Dude, I wish it was 50-50. I mean, I think last year it was 5%. I think this year it'll be 8%. Yeah. So, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit more this year, but Best Buy has been a great partner, but we were the number one selling wallet at Nordstrom's and it's still a small business. I mean, they don't sell that many wallets. Like that's the reality. Like they're a fashion retailer. Like they have, you know, cut and so they have all these other things like, and the wallets are kind of just like put on a desk. So it's been hard to grow those categories there. But I mean, in Best Buy, we'll do tens of millions of dollars this year. So they've been a great partner.
How much do you, I don't know if it's, do you care or do you think about wholesale in terms of branding? Like I talk with brands who are like, we're very intentional. We'll only go into X retailer because it fits. But like Nordstrom is quite different from Best Buy just in terms of, so, but like, are you just thinking about it? If there's demand, if the shopper wants it, I'll send it there. Or are you trying to be a little bit more, I guess, you know, really think about who you expand to on the wholesale front?
Yeah. So the reason why Ridge was so successful is because of the ubiquity of the category, right? It's a category, I mean, the wallet TAM, the men's wallet TAM globally is $10 billion, right? And it's a category nobody cares about. Like it's as big as luggage, but like, you know, I worked in traditional retail. I worked at Ralph Lauren and like there's a hierarchy there, right? Where like the men's buyer, the men's designer, that's number one. Then it's women's, right? Then it's kids, then it's accessories. And at the very bottom, it's men's small leather goods. And like that, they basically just let like interns run that whole program. It's just a category everyone like ignores, right? So because of that, we're able to go into a lot of different places because of the ubiquity and because it's not really an established program for anybody. You know, we're never going to be in a Target. We're just like the MSRPs don't make sense. But the thing about Best Buy is they have like a huge cart size. So like us being $100, us being $200, it totally makes sense because people are spending $1,000 on TVs. We also try to be wherever our customer is. Our core customers, we call them Ed. So it's just everyday dad. And everyday dad buys his clothes at Nordstrom's and he buys his, you know, outdoor stuff from Dick's Sporting Goods or REI or something like that. Or, you know, we're really big in Scheels. I love Scheels as a partner. They're like a employee owned, like REI competitor in like the Midwest. And, you know, he goes to Best Buy on the weekend to check out new gadgets, or he'll go to the Apple store to buy an iPhone. Like these are places like we're going to be wherever Ed's shopping. We want to show up there and be represented.
talk about the product expansion over the past few years, because the wallet, clear, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's clearly your bread and butter. It's what people, what I've always known Ridge for. And, you know, if you type in Ridge in Google, I feel like the wallet's the first thing that's going to come up, but you have a bunch of other products. So was that just based on the founders because they like making products and they thought they would join that? Or do you do market research and say, Ed wants this?
Yeah, and this is why I think we've been so successful. Like, we're still posting 50% plus growth year over year. Never raised any money, profitable the whole time, doing nine figures in revenue. And the reason we've been so successful is because of the product expansion, right? Like, I don't want to pick on anybody, but if you look at like an Away, they still sell luggage, and they've sold luggage for 15 years at this point, right? Like, it's more or less the same piece of luggage. And their entire business is optimized around, you know, selling that luggage. And that's great. What we realized is the wallet business in 2021 ended up getting 1% of global TAM, right? So global TAM, $10 billion. The wallet business had like $100 million that year. And we have all of these wallet customers, millions, like literally probably 6 or 7 million people have bought in these wallets at this point. And it's a very low LTV business. The average person buys a wallet every 7 years. And even then, they probably don't buy it. It gets gifted to them by somebody in their life, right? So we have like these cohorts that they're like, yeah, I love the product. It's great, but I don't need another wallet. There's nothing we can do to get them to buy another wallet. So we were like, okay, let's figure out what other people want. So we tested phone cases and cables and razors. And I was really driving the charge there to like, you know, we have an amazing product team, but I'm like, I don't care what you make, just shots on goal. We're going to waste $2 million this year, take as many shots on goal as possible. And then we really unlocked something in late 2022 with rings. So like men's wedding bands, that is growing 300% year over year, and it did 8 figures its first year. So it's like a massive growth channel for us. And it's why we're still able to post growth, right? Like, even if our wallet business is growing 5%, we have this new, brand new category. Another category nobody cares about or thinks about is men's wedding bands. And I got engaged over the pandemic, and my wife just sent me a link to her wedding band. She's like, here, just buy this for me. I'm like, easy, right? But jewelry stores make almost all of their profit off the men's wedding band category, because you're going to spend $5,000 on a women's engagement ring. It's very easy to trick a guy into spending $800 on just something that's worth 10 bucks or 20 bucks or whatever. That business kind of fell apart post pandemic. People aren't buying, you know, female engagement rings in store anymore. Because of that, there's like just been a boom of men's wedding bands online. We're able to really ride that wave. And, yeah, that's been like a huge growth unlock. And then getting into travel is the same thing, right? Like, we always want to do physical retail, like eventually open stores or whatever, but it doesn't make sense to do that with wallets. Like, each store would have to have like $20 million worth of retail because of the wallets are so small. But we get into bags, we get into luggage. Not only are there like established big players in the space, like Samsonite and Tumi, you know, the AOVs are better, everything works about it. And now we can just go to our wallet customers and be like, hey, if you're not getting married, you don't need a ring. Are you traveling at all? Do you need a bag? And it's just an amazing upsell.
Well, that was my next question, is with these expansions, is it mostly just reacquisition of existing customers? Are you finding it is expanding the pool a little bit? Or when is it pretty much when you launch a new product, you email everyone who bought a wallet and said, hey, we have this too. And then that brings in these sales?
Yeah, so it does both. So we ended up selling out of our travel line. We launched in November of 2023, so just a couple of months ago, and it sold out just off the email, right? Like, so then we've been playing catch up this whole time. The past 5 months, I've just been trying to get as much of these as possible. The challenge is we're not used to selling stuff so big. So like, if we sell out a wallet, we just air freight them, right? You can't do that with luggage. Like, it would cost $100 per import or whatever. So we're having to like, once again, switch our timelines and like going back to the professionalization piece, figuring out how to actually scale up large products with new manufacturers. But anyway, yeah, the first launch was all customer reactivation. And now we're at a point where about 30% of all customers entering the brand enter through non-wallet categories. So, you know, this month there'll be tens of thousands of people who probably don't even know we sell wallets, but are just buying carry-ons or rings because they need them.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about Marcus Brownlee. Correct me if I'm wrong, but did this all start because you tweeted that you wanted to bring in a high profile, you know, new owner into the biz?
Yeah. You know, I didn't like lay out, we're looking to bring on a new owner, but I love YouTube. I've been watching YouTube since I was like 10 years old, right? And if I could share my screen right now, you'd see like four different YouTube tabs open. So like I'm a huge multitasking, watching just a ton of content. And it's been like that forever. That's why we sponsor a ton of YouTubers. And I've been just watching the rise of creator brands, right? And you can talk about Prime or Feastables or Emma Chamberlain Coffee. Like those are the three greatest examples. Those are like top tier creators who are like making and forging their own path there. But I definitely think the future is people buying from people, right? Like, you know, as successful as we are, like how long are people going to want to buy the Faceless Wallet Company brand? Like it's so much better for our storytelling, for our creative, if we could have, you know, a relatable personality people like integrated in the brand. And legacy retailers do this with celebrities, right? Like if you walk through an airport, you're going to see some famous person rocking some product. This is not who we are. We've had a lot of conversations with the celebrities, the UTA, the CAs, and you end up just getting people who are pretty disinterested in the brand overall. And like the actual integration is pretty low. Like you get 4 hours one time a year with this person. And it's like, all right, well, they don't really like us. With Marquez, we've had a relationship for a long time. We've sponsored him for the past couple of years. And, you know, I tweeted out like, hey, we want to bring a creator in-house. We're not just looking for a face of the brand. We want, you know, integrations across their videos. And we want them to like teach us how to make content, going back to us owning a media company. And I said, the dream get is Marquez. If Marquez wants this role, he can have it, right? You know, we were getting close to signing somebody else, but I'm like, hey, I should just make sure Marquez sees this and put it across his desk. And we sent it over to him. And he's like, look, this deal, how it's laid out doesn't work for me, but we can make something work. And so we started doing that in like September of last year, and we just announced it a couple of weeks ago.
It makes a lot of sense, and it's definitely where things are going. You're seeing more, you know, more personalities making investments, launching their own brands. You mentioned Chamberlain, et cetera. But like when you are an existing brand and you bring someone in who is now, you know, a real top-tier player in the brand and has a stake in it, how worried are you that it will become just the Marquez brand and not Ridge itself? Like how are you able to sort of think about this so that the two can grow or you know, have differing paths but still working in tandem?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not worried at all about like him overshadowing the brand. I think that'd be super sick, but like so we haven't like done anything to like put safeguards in there. If I had to play the counter case why it wouldn't happen, it's that we're going to spend like $100 million on marketing this year. So like, it's a really big marketing budget that like is going to be TV ads and Facebook ads and, you know, new product launches and us in retail displays. I would love to pull Marquez through as much of that as possible. Yeah. So I'm not, that's definitely something I'm not worried about. And look, you can look at Chamberlain Coffee or Feastables, two super successful brands with the namesake creator, like very tightly tied to it. Now, we were a brand before Marquez, and so like it's not going to be like that tight of an integration. I don't think we can get there, but I'm not worried that if it does, that'd be awesome if it happens.
You mentioned you're spending $100 million on marketing this year.
Yes,
and you're expecting to do $200 million this year in revenue. So you're spending about half on marketing.
We'll do a little bit more than 200, but. The business can run if we hit a 2x MER. Yeah.
All right. And like, you said TV, like, is it all going to be top of funnel major brand awareness plays? Or like, what are you thinking? What do you think is going to work this coming year?
Well, our bread and butter is always going to be Meta. I think Meta has like the best tools, the best audience, the most amount of reach. And you know, they've had a really bad 8 weeks. I mean, I don't know how topical you want to get like in the weeds.
We love it.
On Meta buying. Amazing January, about midway through February, it seems like there was like some breakage and outage across the platform. I think they're rolling out new AI tools and it sucked for like 8 weeks. But I mean, all things considered, like it's a duopoly for a reason. Like my money will go to Meta or Google, or I have to stop spending money, right? So Meta will get like 50% of the budget. And then it's like second tier social networks. So Pinterest, Snapchat, Twitter, TikTok, they will end up splitting probably 10 to 20% of the budget. And then influencer activations are 10 to 20% of the budget. And then around big flagship sale events. So we have four big sale events. We're in the anniversary sale right now. We have Father's Day. We have sweeps, which is around, you know, NFL kickoff. And then we have Q4. We'll do TV activations for all of those. So like we'll buy MLB playoff games, or we'll buy NFL like 30-second spots, stuff like that.
So you didn't mention Amazon in there, and you sell on Amazon. So what, like how it feels like the conversation, and you know, mostly it's from Amazon brands or Amazon only brands, but also you see the DSP, you see, you know, them going into Prime Video, all that stuff. And they're really trying to woo brands like you to advertise on it. It sounds like that's not top of mind.
I have a large Amazon budget, but it's almost purely PPC.
Yeah.
I don't think they do top of funnel especially good. They've never proven to me that they do top of funnel especially good. How can they reach people top of funnel that I can't reach on a Meta or a YouTube or whatever else? And I'm glad they're rolling out more ad units. The dirty secret is I think all of Amazon's profit has just come from their ad department. And if you look at their earnings reports, the fastest growing single division in that entire company is advertising, growing faster than cloud, more profitable than cloud. But yeah, I mean, I treat Amazon like I treat Google brand spend. It's all just a tax on success.
Got it. Yeah. I feel like they're really working on the narrative, and they're specifically focusing on Prime Video, and that, you know, now you can have a Thursday night football campaign and you can be a small brand that's paying, you know, per view. But I've yet, you know, we'll see the real impact, I guess, in the next year is what I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I definitely want to be first to those type of things. It was kind of like Netflix advertising, where if you look at the CPMs, I'm like, this is way worse than if I just bought through cable, or I bought through linear, or I bought through connected. And, you know, they talk about them like, oh, well, we have a captive audience. I'm like, I'm pretty sure people are watching TikTok when they watch your Netflix shows. So I think I can reach them different places.
Yeah. And I'm sure they're watching TikTok, especially when the ads play. I mentioned this at the top, so I have to bring it up. But, you know, you mentioned you have a somewhat expanding, or you made, you know, one expansion into the media play. You acquired the company Everyday Carry, which is sort of a media brand that talks about accessories. Was that how you'd call it?
Yeah, I think it's a good summary. The leading voice in the Everyday Carry space. Maybe that.
I love that. No, I mean, like, I know that there are these websites that hold such high acclaim for a community that I've probably read their stories but didn't know who they were. But I'm sure they have people who, you know, just constantly consume that content. But I wanted to ask just, why did you guys, like, what was the idea? Was it always in your thought process that you were going to be acquiring some media brand? Or was it just that it fit, you know, it's always rare when you see a brand go into media and it makes perfect sense, in my opinion. So I'd love to hear how this is working out.
Yeah. So every year I give myself a budget of between $1 and $2 million that I just get to waste. And it's just like, you know, one reason why Ridge has been so successful is like, one, we have absolutely no egos over here, where like, you asked me if like, oh, what if Ridge gets overshadowed by Marquez? I'm like, damn, that'd be sick. I'm like, it'd be awesome if people thought when they think of Ridge, they think of Marquez. And that's just like, you know, us going into wholesale or us being professionalized comes from a place where like there's no ego. So how that ties into this is, yeah, dude, I'm just, you know, we have extra money because none of us are buying Lamborghinis. None of us are doing anything crazy like a lot of e-com Twitter boys end up doing. So like we're all pretty content with the way we're living. We have extra capital, so I'm just going to waste it on things that could grow the brand. So, you know, if that is buying Everyday Carry or buying whatever else, like if we have the extra capital, we're going to do it. Now, why do we decide on Everyday Carry? we're already giving them like 50 to 100 grand a year in sponsorship dollars to write articles about us, do posts about us, whatever. And there's a whole theory that like you should buy up and down your P&L. So whoever you're giving money or whoever gives you money, like those are the acquisitions you should be making. So we're already giving them money. We've worked with them for a really long time. And the editor-in-chief wasn't the owner. So like there was, they already went through an acquisition a while ago. So like there's a very talented team at Everyday Carry and they came over at Ridge. So it's Mikey and Bernard. And they weren't the people who owned the thing. The people who were owning the thing were just really doing ad sales. They wanted to exit it because they wanted to focus on crypto. So it just made it made a lot of sense for them to kind of land in-house. And how's it going? Well, you're in the media space, so you probably know.
So it's that, bad.
Like, yeah, so you probably know that advertising's been pretty wonky the past couple of years. There's a massive run-up of a ton of advertising, then there was a drought, and I think we're still kind of in a drought. Luckily, EDC doesn't have to make any money at all. Like, you know, the cost to run EDC is 200 grand, and it's like that's less than a half a day of sales for Ridge or whatever. And what we end up getting out of it is they ended up pivoting to social content mostly. So they've grew, you know, we have over 100,000 people in a Facebook group. We use them for like product testing, get their feedback, whatever we should make. And then Bernard and Mike are actually like they've worked at a gear publication for 10 years. They have an intense knowledge about what works and what doesn't work in the space. So they really helped to like inform like our like internal product knowledge. Like we're really good at marketing, but like getting like product expertise across the entire org, like probably invaluable. I'm super happy with what's going on. I don't know if you guys make any money off of affiliate, but like Amazon affiliate has also been all up and down in the air. Like the entire digital ecosystem on the media side is pretty crazy. But we're doing the best work we've ever done, and I'm really happy with everything. And you know, I've just wanted them to become the number one authority in the gear space, and I think they continue to do that every day. So
yeah. Well, we're going over, but I want to ask more questions just because I find this really fascinating. So was there any fear or have you gotten any pushback? When you have a property like Everyday Carry, there's a community around that and they expect authority. They expect, you know, honesty. People, they're talking about the products. Correct me if I'm wrong. But if you have a brand that's owning it, that could give the perception that things could change in terms of that authority, right? Like has that ever come up in this handing off of the keys from the older owners to you?
No, because so the number one the reason why our Kickstarter was successful is because like the Everyday Carry community really supported us, right? Like they came out of nowhere in 2013 and like bought all the wallets, and like we really owe a lot of the company to like that community. The other thing is our reputation in the community is like as like we call it like as the noob brand. So like the Everyday community really respects what we've done because we bring people into it. Like, you know, we are a mainstream brand through and through, the biggest wallet company ever, right? We every year we add millions of customers into this thing. And it's kind of like we're like the, if you're into watches, like we're like the Seiko. It's like this is maybe the first watch you get or the Timex. It's the first thing you get. And then maybe it opens up this whole hobby and passion for you. So, you know, there's a lot of love and respect in the watch community for Seiko, for Timex, for being that like entry point. And we're kind of like that for the EDC community. We're very much like the new brand. It's like you get into this and then maybe you get into knives, maybe you get into flashlights, maybe you get into this other stuff, right? So yeah, we haven't seen any pushback, and I don't think we shill too hard or anything.
All right, good. As long as there's no shilling, I'm happy as a media professional.
Yeah.
One thing you said, I was listening to an interview you did about a year ago, and you mentioned that, you were like, this was coming out of 2022 into 2023. You said 2022 was rough. 2023 is going to continue to be rough. Things are going to get better in 2024. It sounds like, I'd love to hear if you think that that's still true. It sounds like that's looking good. And just like, I wanted to get a sense of what the overall, you know, you don't have an investor, so you can't really speak about it. But just like, it seems like it's been hard for consumer brands over the last couple of years. Is it going to get easier this year as, you know, in your estimation?
Yeah. So 2022 was tough. 2023 ended up being pretty good for us on the acquisition front. Like we were able to just acquire a ton of customers and grow. I think that'll continue in 2024. When I really think it's tough, it's like, yeah, there's no funding. Like, if you need money to run your business in a consumer brand, it's like, there's no money, right? And it's private equity money is busy doing the cleanup work of 2023 and 2024. Right now, Solo Stove is trading for $220 million, which is like 1/3 or 1/4 revenue. Gap trades at 1/4 revenue, something like that. There's amazing deals to be had on the public market. And why would they want to invest in your thing that's losing money every year when they can just go buy these and do cleanup work, right? That's why it's a still difficult market. The reason why we've been okay is like, we make money every year. Like, I don't need any investors for anything. It's like, we're doing fine. And we thrive when CPMs are low. Like, the less people spending on Facebook ads, the better it is for me. So we've had a pretty good year because of that. I don't know if venture capital will ever come back into the consumer space, because for venture capital work, you need monopolistic outcomes, and that just doesn't happen in the fashion industry. The most you can have of a TAM is 10% before you end up just being cringy. And like, you know, Lululemon probably breaks that rule, or Nike might break that rule, but it's really hard to get those 100 million plus outcomes, right? 100 billion plus outcomes. You know, Lululemon's only worth 50 billion. It's the best brand of all time. So all that to say, yeah, if you're an unprofitable consumer brand, I don't think there's any, there's no more lifeboats, I think.
You should just get out.
Yeah, you should figure out a way to become profitable. But on the acquisition front, like, look, I mean, consumer happens in cycles. There's always going to be brands. There's always going to be discretionary spending. It's 20% of GDP. So I think it'll continue to come back, and we just got to wait for the public markets to turn around.
Got it. You mentioned in that interview I mentioned earlier that you wanted to see a $1 billion exit in the next, I think, 2 years. Is that still top of mind? How's that going?
Yeah, so I get a lot of pushback on that like, it sounds like something a kid would say. Like, it's just like foolish thinking. But here's my pushback. There's three natural places for us to end up, right? All of these are public companies, right? So there's luxury fashion houses like Kering, LVMH, and Richemont. They have started to buy U.S. brands for the first time. Kering bought Maui Jims, and their top line sales aren't looking very good. Gucci sales were down 5% year over year, and they've started to buy American brands, and they're already a house of brands. So we could end up in one of the luxury houses. Then there is, what I would say closer competitors or comps. Tapestry, they own Coach. Coach does $6 billion a year. They have $1 billion a year men's business. They just bought Michael Kors and Versace and all these other brands. They do not have a strong men's brand. If Coach is their biggest men's brand, that's a problem. It's only 20% of the sales. The other one is Samsonite. Samsonite is an American company that was listed in Hong Kong for no reason. They just are going to get delisted. They're going to relist in America. They have Tumi. It would make sense with us landing at any of those places. And it is just a math equation. So if I want to sell for, you know, $1 billion, we need $100 million in adjusted EBITDA, right? Or we need, you know, roughly $50 million in net income. Either one of those things could be true, and we're worth $1 billion to somebody. We're close. I think next year we'll probably get to $50 million in net income. And then it's just if we want to sell or not, right? It's like, does it make sense for the brand with what's going on? So we're getting close.
That's cool. I'll keep an eye out and wait for the announcement. To get to that, you know, $100 million EBITDA, what are you going to do this year? What are the big plans? It sounds like marketing is going to continue to be a big priority. Are you doing more product expansion? What should I expect to see?
Yeah, the big thing will just be getting carry-ons in stock. That's the biggest opportunity in front of us. Like, you know, every time they're in stock, they sell out. And I mean, we have the potential to do $50 million in carry-ons this year, and it's just getting the supply chain to deliver on that. So that is the biggest challenge for us. But look, you know, more wholesale expansion, bigger displays in Best Buy. Probably next year we'll be in all the Apple stores. So more wholesale stuff, more D2C stuff, more international stores. I think we do international really well. International is like 15% of the business now, and we're gonna have a big push into like Asia Pacific. So that's coming up. So a bunch of cool stuff happening in the House of Ridge, man.
Is international all wholesale, or do you have an e-com presence?
We have an e-com presence. So you can go to ridgewallet.ch. Yes. Yeah. All those different domains. And we're launching, I think we don't have the time to get into it, but we have a factory in Arizona that makes US made goods that we sell into Asia, because there's like, that's what they're actually looking for, is like how people in America want stuff made in France or whatever. So we're taking advantage of that, like, you know, global perception arbitrage.
Got it. Oh, I would love to talk more about that. Maybe some other time. But Sean, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Modern Retail Podcast, a show by Digiday. If you haven't already, please do subscribe and head to Apple Podcasts to leave us a review and a rating. See you next week.